Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A very warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, cheap chicken sparks a trade fight as South Africa's poultry industry battles a flood of imports. With SARS cracking down on crypto, can businesses defend their numbers? New data reveals the economic position of women in South Africa and the crisis of sameness facing high-end brands. It's Tuesday, the 18th of August. South Africa's chicken trade fight, I see, is starting to heat up again. The United States is pushing for easier access to the local market, while Brazil is challenging duties on its exports. By the way, Brazil already supplying something in the region of 80-85% of South Africa's imported chicken last year, in spite of tariffs and anti-dumping measures. Now, the non-profit trade advocacy organization Fair Play is warning that further concessions could undermine local producers and jobs, but importers argue protection is stopping South Africa from becoming more competitive. Let me pull all of that together from Fair Play. Francois Baird, a very warm welcome to you. Are these tariffs then protecting South African jobs or simply forcing consumers to pay more for chicken?
Perhaps the best place to start is to note that over the last 10 years, the South African poultry industry has become the second most competitive in the world, only behind Brazil. And this is when, supposedly, according to everyone else, South African poultry would have become less competitive. So we now have the second cheapest chicken on a like-for-like basis in the world. The problem that the South African poultry industry faces is that in Brazil, their competitor has the full weight of the government behind them. In South Africa, the government doesn't really speak to the poultry industry as it should. There's not enough cooperation. And in South Africa, if you look at where the poultry farms are, they are in the areas that are least developed, rural areas. These are the places where chicken jobs are mostly the only jobs available in the current environment of exceptionally high unemployment. So it's not only a matter of being highly competitive, it's also a matter of being highly strategic. The South African poultry industry is a strategic national asset for South Africa, and we believe government should act that way to not protect them against competition, but to ensure that the South African poultry industry doesn't face unfair competition. In other words, dumping, predatory trade. That's what we're fighting.
All right. So you describe imported chicken then as unfair competition. Francois, what then is the clearest evidence that this is dumping rather than foreign producers simply being more efficient?
Well, the simplest evidence is that they've been found guilty of dumping. There's been investigations into chicken being dumped in South Africa. Brazil has been found guilty. Several European countries have been found guilty, as has the United States. So the concession to the United States of nearly 72,000 tons a year is a concession. It's a political concession. It's not because they don't dump. So we believe that anti-dumping means anti-dumping, and therefore the anti-dumping levies are not protecting the industry against fair competition. The industry is highly competitive.
Having said that, though, Brazil, as I referenced, still supplies over 80% of South Africa's imported poultry, despite the tariffs. Francois, doesn't that suggest then that South Africa actually needs imports to meet demand?
Well, what Brazil mostly supplies to South Africa is the product used in polonies and that kind of thing. South Africa does not have enough factories to produce that. It does not really produce large amounts of fresh poultry. And remember that we have asked for value-added tax to be scrapped on certain pieces of chicken that most poor people use, and we have not said only South African chicken, although that would be sensible, but we have said as long as fresh chicken can reach those people who need it most to fight malnutrition in children and pregnant mothers, we're fine with it. I think the South African poultry industry is in a very good position to be of major help in the fight against unemployment, malnutrition, and the health of the nation. And the government should act to work with the industry in making sure that it grows further. Because remember, there's a chicken master plan, and the chicken master plan calls for exports. And neither the government nor the poultry exporters have done enough. The Meat Import and Export Association has not done enough to ensure that exports rise.
What, in your opinion, then, would constitute better cooperation?
I think a good start would be for all the ministers that have a role to play in the poultry industry should start talking to the industry on a more regular basis. At the moment, there's not enough communication. Remember, South Africa faces bird flu, vaccination issues. We still have the compensation issue for people who culled their chickens during the last disastrous bird flu outbreak in 2023 that cost the South African poultry industry 9 billion rand. And all of this together means that the government has to get the ministers of health, of finance, of agriculture, of trade, even the minister in the presidency. I think they should form a task force really to work very closely with the poultry industry to ensure that this strategic national asset is grown as is called for by the master plan that the government instituted. The Minister of Trade has been very good about that, and we think that is a very good example of how collaboration between state and private sector can work to the benefit of South Africa's people.
What does fair play say to importers who suggest that you should stop obsessing about protection and maybe learn from Brazil's export-driven, better integrated industry? Surely there is some truth in that criticism.
The import and exporters should really learn from Brazil's export drive, because they are not applying it in South Africa. If you look at the amount of chicken exported from South Africa, it's negligible. Most of South Africa's exports go to SADC countries. And this is where we believe, if they are serious about playing a role in growing the South African poultry industry, they should focus. And we have not seen any action from South Africa's import-export organizations. What they're happy to do is to fight on behalf of Brazil, because they get fat margins by buying low and selling high in South Africa, but undercutting the industry by selling just below the local producing cost. And this is what we've been fighting for 10 years, and it's been successful, and that's why they are crying foul. They are crying foul because their own foul is not allowed.
Francois Bird, thank you very much indeed. From Fair Play, it's a non-profit trade advocacy organization.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, crypto, I read, is rapidly losing one of its old attractions for taxpayers. What am I talking about? Well, the relative invisibility. From March this year, South Africa's new crypto asset reporting framework began requiring crypto service providers to collect detailed transaction information for SARS, including purchases, disposables, and wallet transfers. So I think the big question for companies is becoming less about whether SARS can see the crypto and more about whether they can justify how they have accounted for it. Joining me now is Mohammed Mayet, who is Director and Head of Tax at HLBCBS Group South Africa. Mohammed, thank you very much indeed. Is this really then a crypto tax crackdown, or is SARS simply getting better at seeing transactions that were always taxable in the first place?
Yeah, greetings to you, Jeremy, and thank you for the opportunity, and greetings to your listeners. I think it's a very important question, and it's a balancing act between, you know, the SARS crackdown on crypto trades per se, together with, you know, something that has already been there for a period of time where, you know, the revenue authority is seeing that as a potential pot of extra revenue where taxpayers in the South African context, you know, have not accounted for crypto correctly in their tax return in whichever form or manner. So, you know, it's a balancing act of the combination of both.
Is crypto becoming more widespread in terms of use in that respect, do you think?
Yeah, so, you know, current data is showing approximate figures of about 6 million South Africans, whether taxpayers registered or not registered, but, you know, about 6 million South Africans playing in the crypto space. And naturally, you know, if you look at 6 million people playing in crypto space, one would then, from a revenue authority perspective, think, okay, so is this 6 million people making profits, losses, playing offshore at other platforms around the world? And as I, as SARS, do I get my rightful share of taxes where the taxes are due? So, you know, on that basis, yes, you know, it is a broader issue to look at in terms of, you know, revenue flows to the authority, which the authority believes that, you know, there is crypto taxes that are due to us in whichever form or manner through these, you know, number of people trading in crypto throughout South Africa.
The framework, as I understand it, requires service providers then to report transactions to SARS, all well and good. So, Mohammed, how much more visibility then does SARS have than it perhaps had in the past?
Yeah, so historically there was no visibility. And then obviously, you know, the data started showing so many South Africans, as I've mentioned, that are dealing or, you know, trading in crypto. And hence the reporting framework from an SA perspective started beefing up. And that means that reporting framework requires two things. The first thing it requires is reporting of certain information, data information, user information, platform information, number of trades. All these finer details is now providing the data intelligence that SARS needs. And SARS would then do its own, in the second instance, its own data mining, and then filter that to, by way of example, you know, an individual's tax return or a business tax return or whomever, and see exactly, okay, we have reasonable amount of data to make a determination that you have traded with crypto on these platforms. And the suggestion is that, you know, you have traded so much. Where's your declaration? Have you made a profit? Have you made a loss? Whatever the case is. So the data integrity is becoming more and more of an important factor to make the determination. So it's a definitely beef up in that reporting framework.
So does using then an offshore exchange or even moving crypto into a private wallet still offer taxpayers any meaningful degree or form of anonymity?
So, you know, in general, when the platforms move, whether you move to, you know, a private wallet, whether you move offshore, there is visibility of your trading account. And each user has a unique, you know, password and an account and a summary of your trades. So let me just give you an example. I mean, if you know, if you're trading in Singapore, if you're trading in Hong Kong, if you're trading in the US, it doesn't matter. You are linked to an account. And whether that account is split into private wallets or not, you have a summary of that trade. And that summary of that trade then makes the determination, amongst other, as your base of what is your activity. And those activities are again critical to the data integration process, because the more data in the reporting framework that I have from these platforms as the revenue authority, the more I can make a better determination of exactly where you're playing, how you're playing, where, in which platforms are you playing domestically and cross borders. So yeah, you know, to answer that question, you know, it's an integrated approach to get hold of the holistic picture of a taxpayer.
And in that respect, the biggest issue then would be one of classification. Why is deciding whether a gain then is capital or revenue so difficult?
Yeah. So, you know, historically, current and going on to the future, the capital versus revenue argument will always be there. We've had many, many court cases in front of our courts around the capital and revenue argument. And it's an ongoing, you know, practice by SARS, by taxpayers to say, am I in the capital box or am I in the revenue box? And that classification has a number of factors to determine whether you fall into the revenue box or capital box. One big differentiation I can just, you know, allude our audience to is the following. I'm a doctor. I have a practice and, you know, I run my, you know, my medical practice through there. But I've decided to potentially, you know, look at crypto, and I see, you know, it's quite reluctant and it gives you good returns. But I want to build a small nest for my family. And I thought perhaps maybe let me play crypto for a long-term benefit. I'll throw $1,000 into it and leave it for 15, 10, 15 years, 5 years, 6 years, whatever the case is, right? And on that basis, what is my income? My income is my practice. And this is like an investment that may materialize and give me some golden nest. So, you know, it's a more long-term approach. It's more capital in nature. Let's turn the coin the other way around. I don't have anything to do and I sit every day of my life and I play crypto. I live off it. I pay my bills. I meet my commitments and I do this every day, every week, every month. And that's my income. And that puts you into the revenue box. This is a very simple example to have this classification and differentiation factor. It can get a bit complicated when you go into more further level 2, level 3 detail. But just this gives you an indication of this argument between capital and revenue.
Mohammed Mayet, I'm going to leave it there. Director and Head of Tax at HLB CBS Group South Africa. Appreciate your time today. Thank you. Think SARS isn't watching? Well, think again. Join MoneyWeb editor Rek van Niekerk in conversation with South African Revenue Services Commissioner Dr. Ngubane Johnson-Makubo at the Money Summit. Together, they'll unpack how SARS has transformed tax collection through AI-powered audits, third-party data matching, and tougher compliance measures. Find out what every taxpayer and business needs to know. Tuesday, the 1st of September at the Sandton Convention Center. Register for free using the promo code MoneyWeb. Visit moneyweb.co.za and secure your seat today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now here's a question. Are South African women genuinely gaining economic ground, or are some of the headline numbers that we see day to day giving us a misleading picture? As I read it, women now account for something in the region of 38% of residential property purchases, all well and good. Yet, they only own around 13% of farmland and remain far less likely than men to own an established business. So let's pull the threads of all of that together. I want to talk to Lisa Nolte, who is New Business Development Manager at the consulting and data science company Afrigus. Lisa, a very warm welcome to you. So if you had to give women's economic empowerment in South Africa a scorecard today, are we actually making progress?
That's a very good question, Jeremy. Thank you. So I think here's a number that's worth celebrating for this Women's Month. So we've seen that since around 2016, South African women have been buying more homes in their own name than men, and they've stayed ahead ever since. And we've seen the rise flowing from 29.5% to the 38% that it is today.
What specifically is accounting for that? What's driving the increase, do you think?
So I think what's driving the increase is it's a couple of reasons. So I think it is, most importantly, women are earning and financially independent in a way that they weren't a few generations ago. So we've got more women in the workforce and more graduating. And also what we're seeing is that the social norms have also shifted. So women are buying on their own rather than waiting. What we've also seen is that the men-only buying has stayed flat whilst women's have kept climbing. So women, they're not overtaking because men have slowed down. They're overtaking because they've kept rising.
And interestingly, if I've read your data correctly, Gauteng has around 1.3 million female-only transfers. But you'll also tell me that some of the stronger percentage gains are in smaller provinces. Just explain that to me and tell me why.
So the fastest growth we are seeing is in the smaller rural provinces, such as Mpumalanga, Limpopo, the Free State, and the Northwest. And the progress is really reaching in places that have waited the longest. So we're seeing real momentum in real communities. And the likely reasons and drivers behind this is that there's a low starting base. There are more affordable homes, so women can buy on one single income. And government housing is also often registered in women's names.
Now, I want to pick up another percentage. Again, you'll tell me if I've got it right or wrong. Against that 38% that you mentioned, women only own around 13% of South Africa's farmland. Explain to me how those two pictures can be so diametrically different.
So I think how we like to look at it is that there are two ways to count ownership. So stock is all the property that's already owned. So that's built up over generations, and it's still mostly men's. So that is the 13%. Now, the flow is what's being bought right now, where the women are at, and that's the 38%, and we're leading. So women can lead today's flow whilst the accumulated stock barely moves, because it takes years for new buying to shift a pile built over a century. But both numbers are true. They're just answering very different questions. So if you think about it, the 13% really is about the past, and the 38% is about the direction that we're heading.
Since April 2025, I think your data says gender had to be explicitly recorded in property transfers. Are we seeing anything now, apart from the numbers that you've cited, that we didn't see before? Is there a bigger macro trend, perhaps, that has emerged?
We are seeing a bigger macro trend. However, you've got to remember that this is just a tick box exercise. So it's just compliance. But it is showing that there are definitely more women that are starting to purchase and be owners of properties.
All right. So property ownership, by and large, is improving. We've cited the 38% and the 13%. But perhaps more worrying is business ownership that is lagging badly. What do we mean by, or what type of businesses are we talking about? And I guess the obvious question here is, why are women able to buy homes but are still struggling to build and scale businesses?
So that really does show the gap. So more women we can see are stepping into business, right? And that's the momentum. But the honest part is that men are still about twice as likely to own an established business. So the stats and the data is currently sitting at 7.9% versus 4.1%. So I think what we're seeing is that there's real progress that has been made, but there is still more to do. However, what's interesting is that for institutions such as banks, I think they could then realize that there's definitely still a market out there where they can approach and run campaigns to support women in business-led areas.
Do you think it's more difficult for women to access finance in that respect?
I wouldn't be able to comment on that, Jeremy. I think so, yes, but I'm not at liberty to confirm on that.
If banks and municipalities had better gender and geographic data, do you think they would be able, or do you think things would look different?
Well, I think women buying homes are exactly the customers that bank wants. So a woman registering a home in her own name usually needs a home loan. She has an income and is building a credit record. So she's a solid growing customer segment. So if your data shows that segment rising fast in specific provinces and suburbs, the banks now know where to focus, which branches, which areas, and which marketing. I think it's also, they're looking at things geographically. So where they really need to do is to focus on the where. So a bank cannot do anything with that single national number, such as the 38%. They have to have the data to support them as to where to put the branches, where to allocate more staff, the lending budgets and the campaigns and such. So we really need to move that national headline more onto the street level plan.
Just a final question, maybe a little philosophical, but from the data, is there stuff that we don't see? Is there perhaps a place where women are falling behind, but the data doesn't actually prove it, and somewhere where you need to mine down a little more deeply?
I think the one area where there is a bit of a blind spot, and that's communal land, where the areas that the map can't see. So what we can see is that around 7.7 million hectares in the Eastern Cape and Limpopo, they sit unregistered. So they're held in a trust and on customary rights that don't fit the title deed model. But now the irony is that Limpopo and Mpumalanga, where women's formal ownership is rising the fastest, they are the same provinces holding much of that unregistered land. Mm. So the place that the gap is likely the widest actually sits right next to you where the gains are the strongest. And we can't see into that as yet.
Lisa Nolte, thank you very much indeed. New Business Development Manager at the consulting and data science company Africus. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Premium brands have spent years perfecting the signals of luxury. What am I referring to? Well, restrained design, obviously great artwork, beautiful photography, elegant stores, promises of craftsmanship and personalized service. The problem, though, is that everyone these days seems to be using the same playbook. There's new research that suggests consumers will pay substantially more for brands they see as meaningfully different. And I think that raises a very simple but important commercial question. If every premium brand looks and sounds the same, what exactly are customers paying extra for? I want to talk now to Nomaswazi Pumo, who is head of strategy at the Lagos Delaney Agency in South Africa. Nomaswazi, welcome to you. So if every premium brand these days looks premium, what actually makes one worth paying more for than the other? It's become something of a conundrum, hasn't it?
Thank you so much for having me. It absolutely has, Jeremy. And I think we are also living in a time where our consumers are way more aware, have more access, and just are quite distinct in terms of what they talk about or what they mean when they are wanting to experience a premium brand. So for them, it's more than it looking good or presenting as if it's premium, but it has to feel premium. The experience has to be premium. It's more of a quality thing that has to come through.
So you argue that premium brands have maybe confused the codes of the category with genuine competitive advantage. What's the clearest sign then that a brand has fallen into that trap?
I think the clearest sign that a brand has fallen into that trap is if you remove the logo and you are not able to tell which brand it is. From a category perspective, if we remove a bunch of logos from a lot of the brands that we deem as premium, we wouldn't be able to tell because they use the same cues from, you know, a language perspective. They look the same. They even use the same faces to be able to push their brand narrative. And it starts feeling very much the same, a sea of sameness, sounding the same. And no one is really coming out strong. No one is textured enough. And there isn't a feeling that I'm paying more for this because it's giving me a new experience. I'm paying more for this because it's giving me a different kind of quality.
So what is the consequence of that sea of sameness then, as far as the more upper end, higher echelon brands are concerned?
I think the thing that brands don't get is that being different, you pay more for choosing to look and feel like everyone else. And being different really does give you that competitive edge and is the one thing that will really start driving meaningful value for you as a brand. But a lot of brands have a fear, and I think we've gotten to a place where people from a brand perspective are afraid of being different, are afraid of coming out and really owning a space and have this, you know, we're living in a world where things look the same. We also box audiences the same, especially in a market like South Africa. We actually cannot afford as brands to box because we have such a textured audience. And the understanding of what premium is in this particular market is something that you know brands are really needing to spend some time in and investment around, because that's the thing that will set you apart.
In fact, you cite research suggesting people will pay almost 40% more for brands they see as meaningfully different. What does meaningfully different actually mean in practical terms, do you think?
I think I'll use a category in which that's doing really well in South Africa. So I'll use the fashion industry at the moment. I mean, if you think about fashion, there are so many brands, without naming any, that are really just coming out and are tuning clothes at a ridiculous pace. And you'll find a lot of people looking the same and a lot of people leaning towards those brands and buying them. But people still love the feeling of paying for something and feeling like I am one of the few that own this particular item. And that's why there's such an incredible rise in our fashion industry, with some of our local brands doing incredibly well because of that thing. So, you know, people, you know, consumers, when we talk about something that's meaningfully different, it's something that, you know, is not found easily accessible, but something also that feels good. There's a durability to it from a quality perspective. But something as well as when you step into a place, or if you own that particular item, it almost places you in a certain category. And, you know, for them, that's something that drives meaning. So it's not just about it looking good, but it's something about that is sustainable, something that can last long, and something that really will bring a particular, you know, change or a particular atmosphere experience in your life once you've purchased that particular item.
But therein lies another set of problems. It's difficult to distinguish meaningful difference, surely, from a brand that simply wants to be unusual for the sake of getting attention.
Yes, that is true as well. So it's not so much about being unusual or being different or being out of the ordinary for the sake of it, but it's being able to also deliver on quality. Something that makes, you know, if I purchase this particular thing or if I subscribe to this particular thing, it's something that is good use for my money. I'm investing in it, and it really needs to feel more like an investment.
And further complicating the problem is premium customers themselves that are becoming a lot more diverse. So do you think the traditional idea of luxury itself has changed, maybe away from obvious status towards other things like convenience, privacy, and we always talk about authenticity?
Definitely the traditional idea of luxury has changed. The South African consumer has changed. So, you know, the idea of luxury will also change. There's also what I'm finding a lot of brands are doing is that they are widening that access gap because of how textured the audience is when it comes to the traditional idea of luxury. And I think before, luxury also used to be, you know, you're paying a bit more for it and you're the only one that has it. But, you know, because of the type of consumer that we have, this access strategy of wanting to have more people feel it, and I think it's become more of a luxury experience that we're seeing come through quite strongly in our market, where, you know, it's not always that is the most expensive thing, but it's there's that element of it feeling very exclusive, but also extremely considered. And that really comes in having a good understanding of the market, a good understanding of the audience and their needs as well, but as well as of their progress, because our audience is quite progressive. We also have to relook what luxury looks like and what it means. And that's what's happening and what we're seeing with this access strategy that's taking shape.
Norma Swazipumo, thank you very much indeed. You are head of strategy at the Lagos Delaney Agency in South Africa. I do appreciate your time. And on that note, we are going to finish today's program. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.